I've got this thing when I got the new microphone, so I hope it sounds better for those listening on the podcast. Today it's a Saturday meeting, and I don't know what the day is, February 17th, I think, and 2018, and we are on Saturdays. We started the big book over, I guess, in November, and we are on There Is a Solution. And today we're going to be reading a few pages. We started page 18. Last week we didn't have a lesson. We had really good birthdays, and so we talked about how God has changed us. And I should have really recorded it because the birthdays were great. And Ed said some powerful stuff too that was great. Today we finished page 17, which is about the two fellowships. And there's the solution, the fellowship that we're here today. We're here together with a common peril. And then the fellowship of the Spirit, where we're working the program and the way out. And we need both. And it's the cement that binds us. And now we're going to look, they're going to look at the illness. They're going to look at the body and why we're different. It's really the first time it's been written this way to the world, why we are different. And then we're going to look at the mind, and then I don't know if we'll get there, but we'll look at what's wrong with our mind and why we take the first drink. And then next week we'll do the powerful page on the problem, and then the next page on the solution, 24 and 25. It says on page 18, an illness of this sort, we have come to believe it's an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. So they're bringing in the people who are involved with the alcoholic, because this book was written for everyone to read it, the alcoholic and the family, to try to understand the disease. And if a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. I think that's true. I was a cancer doctor for years, I can't even describe what my career was like. Anyway, but not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it there goes annihilation of all the things worthwhile in life. Now, annihilation is complete destruction or obliteration. It's not just a little destruction. It's a complete destruction or obliteration of all the things worthwhile in life. I think it summarizes it up. The problem is the alcoholic at times can't see that till at a certain point, but it's been going on the whole time they're alcoholic. And the people around them can see it. And so they say that in the next few lines. It's interesting the way they write. They'll tell you something, and then they tell you what it is. They give you an example of it in the writing, or they'll tell you the problem and then the solution. It's a very powerful way of writing. These sentences were put together very carefully. It engulfs. Engulf means sweep over or surround completely, not just a little bit. We surround completely all whose lives touch the sufferer. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends, and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives, and parents. Anyone can increase the list. And warped means becomes bent out of shape. So we affect the lives of those around us. Notice the word blameless children. I mean, we have children of alcoholics meetings, don't we? Adult children of alcoholics, yeah. Affects everybody. Sad wives, doesn't say happy wives. And parents, anyone can increase the risk. And I think we need to remember that. I mean, it's good to read that. We need to remember what it was like for the people around us. Sometimes we forget. I know I've heard a lot of people come in 30 days, and they say, I'm sober, and why isn't everybody in the house happy? Well, you know, we're like the tornado. We come up out of the tornado. We say, isn't it grand? The sun's shining. You see, we just don't see it. And I wrote here, we need to remember that. And I also wrote that we come to believe it's an illness. It involves no other human sickness can. And I wrote, because it's a spiritual illness. It's It's a spiritual illness. It's so different. And it says, we hope this volume will inform and comfort. Notice the two words. It's going to inform and comfort. It's going to provide some comfort those who are, who may be affected. Now, it doesn't say just alcoholics. You know, the families, everybody, anybody affected by alcoholism, we hope this will inform and give you some comfort. But one thing, it'll tell you, if you're the family, it's not your fault. And it'll tell you, you were powerless to change this. It's a disease of powerlessness. And it says, there are many highly competent psychiatrists. I like the way they say highly competent, not the incompetent psychiatrist. I don't know if it's a play of words there. I'm sorry I recorded that. Don't tell anybody. They are all highly competent. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss the situation without reserve. Anybody think that's true? Well, the other thing is we can't even see the situation truthfully. So we may not even do it intentionally. We just can't see the truth. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist or the doctor. I can't remember the situation, but sometimes somebody's telling me they've been going to therapy for a year or something, and, you know, their life isn't any better. And I said, well, did you tell them about your drinking? They said, well, no. They asked if I drank, and the guy said, I drink a little every day. And there you go. It says, strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. I think we are a little defensive about our illness. Did anybody ever try to hide things from their wives or girlfriends or intimate friends? Anybody try to hide anything? Think about it. It's a legal substance and we're hiding it. So that's the definition of an alcoholic if you've ever hidden alcohol. Right? Normal people don't hide it because you can buy it in the store, but we've got it stashed all over the place. Anybody go to treatment and come back and find some that you stashed and you didn't remember where it was? There you go. I just remember all those empty bottles that I had under the stairs. You know, I didn't want to throw them out because people would see them in the trash. So they were hidden under the attic stairs. I don't know. It took me 2 hours or 3 hours to carry them all up. And I said, you know, I think I really am an alcoholic. I looked at it. I come back from treatment. I don't know if you relate to this. And you see all that. And you say, wow, it really was pretty bad. Anyway, I'm getting off. I'm in a good mood today. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, now this is squiggly writing, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Now, I wrote, what is an ex-problem drinker? You know, that's a good question, too. What makes you an ex-problem drinker? And it says, the ex-problem drinker, once again, look at the way it writes, the ex-problem drinker is one who's found the solution and who is properly armed with facts about himself. Properly armed about the facts about yourself since you've done the steps and not the steps, what we thought about ourselves. You know, we could see the truth. And can generally win the entire confidence. And it says, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Now, I've read this a lot, millions of times, but I saw something new. Until an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And the understanding could be that you're properly armed with facts about yourself, right? And that you understand and you found the solution. And another thing is, if the person doesn't understand what it means to be an alcoholic, then they certainly, you can't accomplish anything. Because remember, the first step of recovery, anybody remember what the first step of recovery is? It's not the one on the steps. The first step of recovery is that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. The delusion that we're like other people must be smashed. I think it's on page 34 or something like that. It's in More About Alcoholism. And so that's the first step of recovery. And that the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty. And notice how, you know, we have new people come in. AA's changed. The world's changed. We have a lot more people coming to meetings. They have a place to go now. But when the new person comes in, does somebody sit and say, I'd like to meet with you, and get their number and say, can I meet with you tomorrow and we'll talk? Or do we just give them a bunch of numbers in the schedule? I don't know what that does, because alcoholics aren't going to call any of those people. But like Ed and others mentioned, do we grab them? I usually grab the new person after the meeting. I don't know if it's good or bad for them. But I say, are you interested in this? Tell me about yourself. When can we get together? You want to come before the next meeting? Because, you know, we have to explain what we're doing here, what it means for me to be an alcoholic, to see if this is something that they want. And also, it begins to break down their, it's hard to come here. It's hard to come to AA for the first time. And it's the beginning of making them feel part of something, that we're here for them. It says that the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, and that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect. Deportment is a personal behavior manner. That he is a man with a real answer, and that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. There are no fees, got this long sentence, there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. And remember, Bill went to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob had been in the Oxford group and knew their steps and knew the Bible, but he didn't know what was wrong with him. Now, why couldn't he get better by doing the Oxford group steps and studying the Bible? Because he didn't understand his disease. He didn't understand why he drank all the time and why he couldn't keep from drinking. And when he drank, he couldn't stop. And so he thought he was a sinner. And he thought that he didn't deserve God's love. And so he couldn't forgive himself. But then when he learned that he was powerless, and he was powerless to keep from drinking, and once he drank, he couldn't stop, then he could forgive himself and he could start to work the steps. At least that's what I've heard him say. So what is our attitude? We have a sincere desire to be helpful, and we have to act as if we have an answer. And so if you're going to work with someone, do you have a real answer to work with them? Think about that. And no attitude of holier than thou. We're all together. It's a horizontal relationship. It's not vertical. Sponsors is a horizontal relationship, hand in hand. We walk together, not in front of or leading, because we're all the same. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. I think that's a reference to Scripture. And that means we're born again. We were dying, right? And we were raised from the dead to walk again. None of us makes the sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. But we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. I think that's something new people don't realize. We're very happy to stop drinking. Because that certainly eliminates one problem in our lives. But what happens if we just stop drinking? We're sober. And remember what sober means. Son of a bitch, everything's real. And sober is when we have alcoholism. We drink to treat it. We drink to treat alcoholism, but alcoholism is a disease of sobriety, of being sober, because we don't have any solution to living a life separated from God. And we don't have a solution to how we can manage our lives successfully. And then we live in self, and we're self-centered, and we have all these character defects, and we harm people, and we're full of resentment and fear. So no wonder we drink, right? But if we have to eliminate drinking to begin, right, because we have to have a clear mind, and we can't be doing the behaviors drunk, to work the steps. I really think the steps are work better sober. Does anybody agree with that? And the other thing, I wrote up elimination of drinking at the beginning, because that is not a spiritual solution. Just stop drinking. And that's why just say no doesn't work. It's not a spiritual solution. We need a spiritual solution because we have a spiritual problem. And then he says, a much more important demonstration for me as the alcoholic is the demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And I don't think we talk about that enough at meetings, that we're supposed to practice these principles in all our affairs. And what are the principles? And the principles we're going to talk about tomorrow, because we're going to be doing some of the 10th step and, 6 and 7, drop the rock. But the principles are the opposite of our character defects. And the principles are the, if you look at our spiritual checklist, it's the right-hand side. And if we, it's how we be. If we be a certain way, then we will do a certain way. And we're supposed to do it in our homes, occupation, affairs. So we're supposed to live this way of life. And it says, all of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort we're going to describe. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to the work. If we keep, now look at this, this is 1939. If we keep on the way we are going, there's little doubt that much good will result. They were trying, they wrote this book to be of service, right? They wrote this book to be helpful. They had a solution that they wanted to share with the world, and this book is their testimony. But the problem would hardly be scratched. They had no idea what was going to happen once they wrote this book. They couldn't have imagined that there'd be, what, 35 people in the room today? They had 40 people sober when they wrote the book, or 60. It says, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Notice how they talk about us, dropping into oblivion, and I think that's a really good way of saying it. The words here are so powerful. I don't know if you feel that way, but I do. Many could recover. Now, it doesn't say all could recover. It says many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. And I wonder why they put many, because not all of us can recover, because we won't take the first step, right? And some of us are constitutionally incapable of being honest about our situation. How then? So here's the thing. How then shall we present which has been so freely given us? Remember, and I like what Ed says, he's relieved from the obsession of alcohol, right? God relieved it at that moment. That's what happened to me. It's a great way of saying it. I was relieved of the obsession to drink. And it's a grace. It was freely given to me. Now I had to do things to accept it. I had to let go and submit and be humbled. And then I had to continue to do that. But it's a gift freely given. I mentioned that last week that, you know, we celebrate birthdays. We're all proud of it and happy that we're doing it. It's certainly a change. It's a great thing. But the most important thing to me about the birthday is the humility that I was given this gift and that I was able to stay humble and submit to God. It's a gift. Anybody remember the moment of complete defeat? And think where we are today and just think, wow, if that doesn't make you grateful and humble, I don't know what will. So they're going to do it. How are they going to give what was so freely given them? So this is why they wrote the book. We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. So the first thing is tell us the problem. We're going to get some of the problem in this chapter. And we saw some of the problem in Bill's story and Doctor's opinion, right? And then in more about alcoholism. And then they're going to bring, what they're going to bring to this is our combined experience and knowledge. So this is their testimony, and it's combined experience and knowledge. They have knowledge of God and their experience in finding their knowledge of God. So you can't argue. Some people might not like the book, right? But you can't argue. It is what it is. It's their experience and knowledge. Now, the power of the book is that I know I did this, and I have some experience and knowledge now, and it's changed my life. And there are other people in this room that have done this, and they have knowledge and experience that changed their life. So we're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope with the new person, and it's our experience, strength, and hope as the result of this book and doing the program. It says, this should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem. And notice it says, a useful, doesn't mean this is the only one that's in the world, but this is what they did. And notice, it doesn't say alcoholic. It says anyone concerned with a drinking problem. Now we have some people that have actually read this book and done the steps who aren't alcoholic, and their lives have gotten better. And remember, we were reading, working with others, and they were saying, well, if the alcoholic doesn't come, don't give up on the family. You know, read the book with the family, do the steps, because these are spiritual principles that are in the Bible. This is how we're supposed to live. And so it's not just the alcoholic. Of necessity, there will have to be a discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their nature, controversial. I believe after doing these meetings these many years, there's nothing you could do that's not controversial at AA. And there's really nothing you can do that isn't going to have some controversy because people have their opinions. And that's just the way it is. The one thing I've tried to learn is to not to be dependent on people for approval and try to just do the right thing. But that's hard to do, right? It says nothing. So that's what they did. They said, it's going to be controversial. We don't care. They said, nothing would please us so much as to write a book which could contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal, but it's an ideal. And most of us, now, I really like this next line because I think this is what the deal is. This is what the deal is in AA. So see what you think. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Isn't that love and tolerance is our code? And real tolerance of other people's shortcomings, and it's an attitude. Remember, we're talking about a change in our attitude. That's what Dr. Young told Roland Hazard, right? Our lives, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help their needs. So there, in these two sentences, you could tell somebody what the whole program is. I want tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints, respect for their attitudes, and my whole life really depends upon my constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And it doesn't say alcoholics, it's just other people. Remember, it says turn your thoughts to those you can help whenever you're disturbed. And it says constant thought of others. I read it for a while, and I thought it said constant thought of me and how I may meet my needs. But they changed the words over the years, and it's constant thought of others, which is the opposite of self-centeredness. Now, I don't know about you, but I might not have been much, but I was all I thought about before I came in here. And I could still do that, but I try to do it less. Less and less all the time. You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why. So if you're reading the book, you're on page 20, you've read Doctor's Opinion. You may want to know how, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, because at the time this book was written, alcoholics were considered hopeless and put in asylums. They were just locked up, so they couldn't hurt themselves or other people. We have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Does anybody here want to know how to recover from a hopeless condition of mind and body? Isn't that a good question? Well, guess what it says. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may be already asking, what do I have to do? So they're saying in this line that an alcoholic has a hopeless condition of mind and body. But it can't be hopeless because they've recovered. And they use the word seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. That's another word that they put in the book. It says that in the foreword. We had a seemingly hopeless condition of mind. It seemed hopeless to you. Did anybody remember when it seemed hopeless? But it wasn't, because there is a solution. And they had recovered. Now, a lot of people wonder what recovered is. I think Mark mentioned it well at his birthday. It's the idea that I'm not obsessed with drinking all the time, that I'm free from the obsession, the constant obsession to drink. And it doesn't mean that I won't get it, but I'm free from it. And when I see alcohol, I can see that it's a bad idea. Now, I can't do that without God. So what we're saying is that we have some fit spiritual condition at this point. Does this make sense? And so when I'm in fit spiritual condition, I will react sanely towards alcohol. Now, if I stop being in fit spiritual condition, I won't act sanely regarding alcohol, and it'll sound like a good idea. And people who have been around and then gone out can tell you that. So it says, what do I have to do? Now, Sandy Beach says, that's really the only question you're supposed to ask when you come in here. I've never heard anybody ask me that. But they're supposed to say, what do I have to do? And he actually says, what do I have to do next? So if you're a new person, you cause a sponsor, you're supposed to ask the sponsor, what do I do next? And it says, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. That's why I study this book. It answers the questions of what do I have to do? And if I do it, the results are good. My life is better. I feel good. I see things differently. I still get judgment and intolerant. I still get bothered, but I don't have to stay there anymore. And when I do, I can recognize it. I feel really bad. You know, I say, gee, I wish I hadn't have been that way. And I don't want to be that way anymore. And remember, it says at night, we don't beat ourselves up with morbid reflection, but we look at the day and then we say, God, I ask God for forgiveness every night and how I can have corrective actions the next day. So every day where we're going to fall short, we're going to fall into our character defects, but I ask God to forgive me, and if he forgives me, which he does, then I can forgive myself. And then I can, if I forgive myself, then I'm open to how I can change. If I'm still beating myself up, well, then I won't hear the corrective measures. And it says, we shall tell you what we have done before going into a detailed discussion. It may be well to summarize some points as we see them. And this is how people see us. I think they still see us today. How many times people have said to us, I could take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. Now, that's what they do in the beginning. But at the end, they say, would you just stop drinking? Right? They don't mince around. Please, are you drinking? Don't drink anymore. His willpower must be weak. I like that. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. I heard one guy said that if a sweet girl came between him and alcohol, the girl's gone. Yeah. And remember, if anything comes between us and alcohol, it's gone. Or alcohol and drugs. Drugs are the same way. Alcohol and drugs. Anything comes between that, they're gone. They're history. The doctor told him if he ever drank again, it would kill him, but there he is all lit up again. I can't remember how many conversations I had with people when I was younger. You know, I was drinking quite a bit, but I saw that as a relief from the stress of internship and residency. You can understand that. And I would see people, I'd wheel them up. They'd have pancreatitis. They're crutching their belly. They're throwing up. They're miserable. Oh, my God, doctor, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to quit drinking. I guarantee, I'd never go drink again. And you know, they go, I don't know why you're wheeling them up. Because I'm an old guy. When we were internships, we had to wheel them up. We had to put the IV in. We had to do it. And I said, gee, this son of a bitch was here last week. You know, and here it is. And then we're spending all this money on medicine and all this stuff. And we know they're going to go drink the next week. It was very frustrating. But now we have a solution. I'm just going to read a couple more paragraphs, we'll open it up. Now, these are commonplace observation on drinkers. So you see, people can see this, so they wonder what the hell is wrong with us. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. And before this was written, nobody had any understanding. Now, that's what's powerful. They didn't understand our obsession of the mind and our allergy of the body. And we see these expressions for people whose reactions are very different from us. If you're not powerless, it's very hard to understand powerlessness of this disease. For the people who see us, they don't understand because they have power and they say, well, gee, what's wrong with these people? Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up alcohol entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Any of those in here? Don't say yes because then you're in trouble. Your ego's starting to kill you. Remember I asked Stu, I said, well, are you really an alcoholic? And I was being facetious. And then he thought about it for a long time and said, well, maybe I'm not. You know, the last DUI was just took the wrong road.
That's right.
Jesus, I should have had the last drink. And, it's a funny story, but isn't that true? Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have a habit barely enough to gradually impair him physically or mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If it's sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, warning of a doctor, he may stop. Now, there may be heavy drinkers in AA. I don't care. If this works for you and changes your life, God bless you. But what about the real alcoholic? So what's a real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, and this is powerful. He may or not become a continuous drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So a real alcoholic has the phenomenon of craving. The real alcoholic has the allergy to alcohol. He cannot control how much he drinks once he starts. So they're going to talk about control here on page 21. And we'll pick it up with this next week. I'm going to open up so we have some time to talk. And then on page 23, they're going to say, well, darn, none of this would happen if you didn't take the first drink. Right? And so we're going to look next week at the choice and control. Now, Joe and Charlie said that when you begin to lose all control of liquor consumption once he starts to drink, you're drunk when you do that. Now, I don't know when that point was. A lot of people lose control from the first time they ever drank. I don't think normal people remember their first drink. I have to ask my wife if she remembers her first drink. But alcoholics all remember their first drink. Anybody in this room not remember your first drink? I remember it tasted like crap. Yeah. I was 17. You know, I was a good boy, so I didn't drink. And in those days, you couldn't drink before you were 21 in Maryland, where I grew up. And I went to Duke, and we had you could drink beer if you were 18. And so we had, like, the gathering of the little boys and girls, you know, the freshmen. And they had a pitcher of beer. So I said, I'll have a beer. And I drank it. I said, this is really terrible. I'll have another one. I mean, I do remember that. I drank three or four, and I felt pretty good, but it didn't taste good. And then a month later, we were going to have a keg. And we were going to invite, there were not a lot of girls at Duke then. The men were more than girls. So we would bus in the girls from the local college. And we all give a few dollars so we could go out, because the freshman girls all went out with the upperclassmen at Duke. So we had the keg. And I remember thinking, oh, we're going to have a keg. Good deal. Well, guess who was throwing up at 2 in the morning? You know, and I don't remember that. I don't remember that the next time we got the keg. Anybody relate to any of this? You know, I wasn't even 18 yet. Anyway, I'll open up. You've heard enough. Thanks for coming, and thanks for listening. We'll open up next week with, we'll look at control and choice. Thank you.